Okay, I was asked to discuss simulations of the baryon distribution at high redshift. I'll review work by a number of different groups, but stuff that's not otherwise attributed is by some combination of these collaborators and myself. I will try to go bang, bang, bang through these four topics, talking mostly about the last two. I have the most to say, but if we're talking about the history of the baryons, well, you know, there's all this stuff. The baryons form in the nuclei, the baryons form into atoms. You don't need to simulate any of that. But once you go through recombination and start getting the structure formation, we get to the realm of simulations. And one of the interesting developments in the last few years has been people trying to actually simulate the formation of the first stars. And here we, in fact, have the first star in the universe, at least this theoretical universe of Abel, Brian, and Norman. And what's quite spectacular here is the dynamic range of this simulation. You see it blowing up by factor of 10 after factor of 10 after factor of 10. An overall object that has a mass of 10 to the fifth solar masses for the whole structure, but zooming way in here, and this is the temperature structure of the central object at the end, and you know, here is the 200 solar mass cold core in the middle that is going to become the first star in the universe. Tom Idel showed me on Monday that they've now, you know, blown this up by yet another sort of factor of 10 to the fifth. They're not quite to stellar densities yet, but they're remarkably close. This is the other group that's been working in this field, Braun, Coppi, and Larson. They, instead of starting from a full cosmological initial conditions, have started from a rotating spherical object, and this then fragments into clumps. And they get this sort of disk of stuff, face on, edge on. You can see these clumps that are, again, sort of a couple of hundred solar masses. This business of having multiple clumps in a disk seems to result from the way they've chosen their initial conditions, but there's a similarity to the Abel et al. Results in that these clumps tend to have masses of 100 or a few hundred solar masses. And that seems to result from the temperature that molecular hydrogen cools the gas to, can get it down to a few hundred degrees, but not below that. So the suggestion is that probably these things won't further fragment. So, you know, the results in this field, well, first of all, is that it's being done at all, which is very impressive. And the common result seems to be formation of sort of 100 or a few hundred solar mass clumps that maybe aren't going to fragment further. So that leaves the interesting possibility that all population 3 stars are actually high mass. Key questions still to be addressed. What is the efficiency of the population 3 star formation? And what happens once these things actually start emitting radiation? Do they shut themselves off? And if so, how? This is a challenging field because you've got to get very high resolution while still maintaining the cosmological context. And Abel, Brian, and Norman seem to have solved that very well, although there's still a question of what happens once you actually get these self-gravitating clumps. Where do they go? And eventually you have to start worrying about the radiative transfer of these objects on themselves. Moving somewhat down in redshift to the epoch of reionization, the state of the art, at least in terms of published simulations, is this work by Gnedden, 1999, building on his earlier work with Ostreicher. And here I'm going to flip through a sequence in which a time sequence. This is starting at redshift a bit above 11. And in each of these, this is the neutral fraction, the gas density, and the gas temperature. And so you can see at this point, we've had some formation in this, some star formation in this region here, which has begun to ionize the low density region close to it, but most of the rest of the universe is still neutral, still in the pink. And now if we go from a big jump from redshift 11 down to redshift 7, and if you look at Nick's paper, you can see lots of times in between. But here we get to the point where the universe is about 50% ionized. And again, most of this ionization, whether you get ionized depends. You want to be in a low-density region that is close to a high-density region, because you need the high-density region to be your source of stars. But the low-density regions are the ones where the radiation breaks through and comes out. I should say that this is all done with an approximate treatment of radiative transfer that doesn't have shadowing in it, but I think it still captures something about probably how this process grows. This is showing the ionizing background intensity. You can see it's slowly climbing. It's still relatively low, and that's a mean in the box, and at the moment, within the box, it's still very inhomogeneous. But if we go to redshift 5, then these things start to overlap, and now we've gone to a transition where most of the universe is reionized, and we're left with some neutral clumps along the high-density regions where the ionizing radiation gradually has to eat its way in and ionize the stuff. And so most of the medium has been heated to temperatures of around 10 to the 4 degrees and somewhat hotter in the higher density regions. And you see there's been this very rapid jump in the mean ionizing background intensity because now all these, now once these regions sort of percolate, then one piece of the universe can see many different sources. And if I go down to redshift of 5, the point at which Nick's stop this simulation, we're now left with most of the universe having gone to a quite low neutral fraction, around 10 to the minus 5, and higher neutral fractions still in these filaments, but even those are now mostly ionized, but the denser the gas, the higher the recombination rate, hence the higher the equilibrium neutral fraction, and now J starts to grow slowly again. Now, another thing that one can attempt to do is follow the tracking of metals into the intergalactic medium, since we'd like to know why there's all this carbon-4 and other stuff. I think no one is at the point where they can do a simulation that really does this in a fully consistent way, because if you're resolving some cosmological volume, you don't have enough resolution to actually follow the tracking of the gas outside of the galaxy. So you from the galactic scale out into the surrounding medium. So really one is either putting in some numerical approximation or some theoretical assumption for how that happens. I'll show you a very preliminary result from Anthony Aguirre at Harvard, who is trying to follow metal enrichment in these simulations from our group. These are shown at redshift of 3, and I'll be showing you more things from these simulations later. This is the gas density in a box that's 50 H inverse megaparsecs co-moving on a side, simulated at low resolution. And I'll later on be showing you some results from smaller boxes this size. Done. This is a simulation with the same resolution as this. This is higher resolution, by a factor of 8, higher by a factor of 64. You can see that there's a lot of small-scale structure in here that isn't in here and therefore isn't in here. This is a generic problem in doing these kinds of simulations, is you want to have large volumes, but you also want to have high resolution, and it's hard to get both. From this plot, I'll suggest we just focus on the bottom part. So what Anthony has done is assumed that that the forming galaxies in these objects, about which more later, in these simulations, about which more later, drive winds that carry not much mass, but carry a fair amount of metals. And that's reasonably plausible. It's not compelling, but it's plausible if basically the gas sort of escapes through chimneys that are blown by the first set of supernovae. And then once that gas gets out to the point where it's in pressure equilibrium with the surrounding IGM, then it gets mixed up by the subsequent motions in the intergalactic medium. Here, from the highest resolution simulation, the red line shows from the highest resolution simulation what we get at redshift of 3. This is at the mean density. The metallicity is about 10 to the minus 2 solar, so that's somewhat reasonable. If we take the larger volume simulation, go to an overdensity of 1,000, the metallicity is still less than a tenth solar, which is too low to explain cluster metallicities. On the other hand, it's also the case, if we look at redshift 3, you can see there's a big difference between the high resolution and the lower resolution simulation down here. So we're almost certainly underestimating metallicities. But this is a challenge in doing this problem right, is you'd like to have the volume to get the clusters, but you need to have the resolution to get the galaxies that would be the source of the metals. But that's one way of trying to attack this problem. So I think we've got a sort of plausible picture of how reionization occurs. it looks like it's a highly inhomogeneous process because the sources are in the dense regions, but the low-density regions are ionized more easily. If you just let these galactic winds go out and don't further mix things, then they won't enrich the intergalactic medium, but the kind of mixing that it seems as though it's fairly plausible that the kind of mixing that does occur due to the dynamics may be able to spread the metals out to relatively low-density regions. We'd like to know what the impact of reionization is on subsequent galaxy formation. Do galaxies sort of regulate the rate of their own formation? What's the impact in terms of temperature fluctuations in their evolution, which will become important for interpreting the Lyman Alpha Forest? I think I don't have time to say things about helium reionization, but perhaps some of the subsequent speakers will address that. Let me now go on to a more general discussion of the intergalactic medium. Starting with the Lyman Alpha Forest, where Michael has already given you the basic picture. So you have a simulation like this. This is the highest resolution of those simulations I showed before. And, you know, the basic picture is quasar line of sight goes through a box like this and encounters regions of high density, low density, high density, low density, and they imprint this pattern of fluctuating absorption. So you can put quasars behind random lines of sight in your box and calculate the predicted absorption spectrum and get a reasonable match, at least qualitatively, to what we observe in the Lyman Alpha Forest. And you can also now ask, what are the physical properties of the systems that are producing this? As Michael emphasized, they're very low density, they're very highly ionized, and that actually suggests a way of viewing the forest of, instead of thinking of it as a collection of discrete absorbers, to think of it as a continuous field, a fluctuating pattern imprinted by a fluctuating intergalactic medium. And what makes that point of view powerful is the following feature that emerges out of the simulations, and Lam Hui will give you more of the physical explanation for it in his talk, I think. This shows the density position of all particles in that simulation in the over-density temperature plane. So here's the cosmic mean density. You can see we have shock-heated gas at high density. We have dense gas that settled into galaxies, which I'll show you later. But most of the mass is actually in this low-density component, which I've blown up here. This has most of the mass and occupies nearly all of the volume. And most of the gas there lies on this tight correlation between density and temperature that emerges from the interplay between photoionization heating and adiabatic cooling. So now we go back to the Gunn-Peterson formula, which tells the optical depth is proportional to the neutral hydrogen density, which is proportional to the square of the total density, because this gas is in photoionization equilibrium, times some temperature coefficient that reflects the lower recombination rate at higher temperatures. And if you just measure this slope, put it in here, we get the tau is approximately proportional to density to the 1.6 power. And therefore, the ratio of the flux to the continuum flux is e to the minus some constant times rho to the 1.6. And this constant embeds a lot of different things. The thing it's most sensitive to is the baryon density. But one can fix it by matching one observation, such as the mean flux decrement, learn things about the baryon density in the ionizing background. And then the fluctuations in the forest are all connected to the fluctuations in the density field. And this is what makes the Lyman Alpha Forest such a nice cosmological tool, is that, you know, this picture is only approximate, but it does show that there's a tight correlation between the thing that we can observe and the thing that we care the most about, the underlying density field. And this is just a test of that picture. This shows the optical depth pixel by pixel, not line by line, but pixel by pixel in artificial spectra from the simulations. The solid line is this relation, and the value of the constant A is fixed by the parameters of the simulation, so there's no fit here. And the points, you know, most of them lie pretty close to the line. Some of them scatter low because some of the gas is shock heated and therefore at higher temperatures. That's this gas up there. And when we go to frequency space, we have to worry about thermal broadening and peculiar velocities. Those certainly add scatter to this, and that's, you know, you need simulations or more sophisticated approximations to account for that. But basically, you know, this at least gives you a good intuitive picture of how the Lyman Alpha Forest is working if you view it as a sort of continuous field. So that's what's made it popular as and powerful as a cosmological tool, and the results from applying this have been sort of boring in the sense that we find that everybody's favorite model pretty much works. Michael showed you this comparison between the flux power spectrum from his high-res data and the Chen and Ostreicher numerical simulation of a lambda CDM model. And this is the differential form of the cumulative flux distribution that he showed. So this is sensitive mainly to the amplitude and shape of the power spectrum of the underlying dark matter distribution. This is sensitive to the amplitude of fluctuations, but also to whether the primordial fluctuations were Gaussian or not, because if you make them non-Gaussian, then you change this distribution of rho over rho bar, which in turn would change the distribution of flux. So the fact that these things agree supports the amplitude and shape of the power spectrum and the assumption of Gaussianity in the standard cold dark matter-ish models. This is, we have managed to make an even larger collaboration and Rupert Croft has particularly been analyzing data from Burles, Kirkman, and Teitler using this method to infer the mass power spectrum. And here's the current status of those results, and I think the mean isn't going to change, but we're arguing over the error bars. But you can see that the inferred mass power spectrum sort of agrees very well with a fairly boring model, disagrees with cluster or Kobe normalized omega equals 1 models, and one can combine this with other constraints to get at omega or other combinations of cosmological parameters. And just to show you other things that might be doable with the Lyman alpha forest, I'll show you a preliminary result using an approximate numerical technique by Narayanan and Dave, where the points here are the flux correlation function, not the line correlation function, but flux correlation function, again from the McDonald et al. Paper. The blue line is from the lambda CDM model, and these other lines show what happens if you replace the cold dark matter with warm dark matter of 500 electron volts or 200 electron volts. That suppresses the small scale power at a level that should be easily detectable. So those are the kinds of things that one can attempt to test with the Lyman alpha forest. And I'll say a little bit more about the rest of the IGM at the end. But basically, I think the key results, we've got this nice explanation for the Lyman alpha forest, shows it's the main baryon reservoir at high redshift, suggests this continuous field point of view, where here this also includes the peculiar velocity term and the convolution with temperature. The cosmological results are fairly boring. And as time goes on, the Lyman alpha forest evolves because the universe is expanding, the mean density is dropping, and therefore the optical depth is dropping at a given density. And eventually that gets countered by the fact that the ionizing background starts to drop. There's still a lot of work to exploit this full cosmological potential of the Lyman alpha forest. There are questions about what beyond this simple picture, methods of heating the forest, does that produce temperature fluctuations that are an additional source of structure in the forest? Evolution of the metallicity and detectability of the low Z baryons maybe is something we'll come back to at the end. And the real challenge as far as this diffuse intergalactic medium goes is basically, now we can potentially do precision astronomy, but then characterizing the numerical uncertainties and physical uncertainties at this necessary level of high precision is the challenge. Okay, let me move to galaxy formation. I'll go a snapshot from this highest resolution simulation I've been showing. This is at redshift of 10, and already there are a few dense knots of gas. There's some stars forming in those objects, so these kinds of simulations do tell you, yes, there should be little tiny galaxies out there for observers to find at redshift of 10. Let me come, I'll show a plot later that I think shows that. Redshift of 5, development of now a lot more structures. Thank you. This is redshift of 3, where now I'm showing you not the density distribution, but the temperature distribution. And you see we've got, you know, warm gas, sort of 10 to the 4 degrees in these filaments, million degree gas in these clumps, which doesn't look so good since we don't think stars form directly out of million degree gas. But if I just zoom in on that central clump, you find what you always find in these kinds of SPH simulations, that these high density regions are actually two-phase. We have hot gas, the yellow particles at millions of degrees, and embedded within that lumps of gas that has cooled down to 10 to the 4 degrees, settled into little dense lumps. And I'm going to show you a blow-up of, I think it's that one, the dark matter is also is mixed throughout this and somewhat concentrated around those objects. So now I've blown it up to show you just 5 kiloparsecs, showing you the cold gas, which is in a rotationally supported disk, which I've turned face on. And the resolution, the gravitational resolution is about that. Okay, so at best marginally. We turn that cold gas into stars and return energy to the intergalactic medium with something like a Kennicott sort of law. And this shows now an edge-on view showing the yellow particles are gas that's been converted into stars, and the red particles are still pure gas. The blue is the central parts of this dark matter halo. So you do these kinds of simulations, and it's gratifying that things come out that look reasonably like they might represent the luminous inner regions of galaxies. Let me show you just one picture. Well, actually, I'll show two pictures from this large volume simulation at redshift of 0. This is the whole box showing just the particles that have been converted into stars. And it looks like there's just some sort of super globs in the centers of these clusters. But again, if I blow that up by a factor of, that's a factor of 8. I wanted to look for my factor of 64. There we go. You see that, in fact, the centers of these structures have, you know, here we've got a big central galaxy, some little satellites, a lot of further out satellites. So we have a fairly easily identifiable galaxy population. And we can study things like the mass function and clustering properties of such a population. Okay, so let me conclude with two results. And two quantitative results from these simulations. And the comparison between them, I think, is interesting and somewhat paradoxical. In this, I'm showing at redshift of 3, the data points are the Edelberger and Steidel Lyman-Break galaxy luminosity function with no dust correction and with their best estimated dust correction. And the histograms now come from this series of simulations. The green is from the largest volume but the lowest resolution, so it turns over at low masses. And the because we're not resolving lower mass systems. But the red is a smaller volume, but higher resolution, so it kind of picks up where this one leaves off, takes us somewhat further down. The black is actually the same volume as the red, but now higher resolution still, so we're getting further down the mass function before we lose things. The blue shows what happens. It's the same simulation as the red, but using a baryon density of 0.03 instead of 0.047. So that shows the effect of changing the baryon densities to shift things over to here. If we use the standard Big Bang nucleosynthesis, standard referring to Burles and Teitler, that would be these other histograms. And, you know, they come pretty well on the dust-corrected Lyman-Break luminosity function, except perhaps overproducing the faintest objects. And now if we come to redshift of 0, now I just have two simulations. At that redshift, the big box, shown by low resolution, shown by the solid histogram, with a smaller box, higher resolution, shown by the dotted histogram. And now I've taken a B-band luminosity function and shifted it into a stellar mass function, just assuming different stellar mass to light ratios. And there are two problems that we see here. The first is that in order to sort of fit things in the body here, what we need is a stellar mass to light ratio of 10. So that would require either a large brown dwarf population or lots of dust extinction or something else. Anyhow, that seems like an unreasonably high value. And even if we do that, we do have a few very bright galaxies in the centers of the clusters that appear to have overformed. So basically, we're currently in the situation where I think, you know, the star formation rate at redshift of 3 looks not too far off, but the corresponding mass function at redshift of 0 does look rather far off. So let me stop there and just leave up those conclusions and the small type version of all the conclusions.
I'm a little worried about this stacking of boxes. I realize you have to do it, but as far as I understand, the star formation in these simulations is not really converged, and that when you increase the resolution, that the star formation rate is not stable.
Well, I don't think that's... So I think actually what stacking the boxes shows is that that isn't really true. If we ask about... find the best example, which would be this. Right. So if we ask about the total star formation rate, integrating over all galaxies, then that's certainly correct, because as we go to higher resolution, we pick up lower mass galaxies. So we cannot say what the global star formation rate is predicted by the simulation. We can say what it is for galaxies down to some given luminosity. So the fact is that the histograms, you know, if the histograms weren't joining up, then I think we'd say, you know, we don't know what to say. As it is, once we can say they, to the extent they line up, we can say there's some range over which we know things, but you're right that the global star formation rate depends on, you know, what happens down here, and that we still don't know. Oh yeah, all of these are, I mean, there's no parameters to change here, so.
David?
Yeah.
You described the Lyman-Alford force in terms of purely gravitational forces. But if one takes seriously the metallicity measurements, supernovae release about a kV per baryon for a solar metallicity, meaning that if you take 10 to the minus 2.5 solar metallicity, the supernova that enriched the intergalactic medium released a few electron volts per baryon. And that's comparable to the temperatures that you're dealing with. Why are you justified in ignoring these phenomena?
Well, so I think this is one of the very interesting questions, right? How can the medium get enriched and apparently not get greatly disturbed? And I think the observational evidence that it's not greatly disturbed on top of that is, I mean, at one level you can say, well, these are, so you can take the point of view of, if we're trying to do cosmology, then all of these things are these additional possible effects are uncertainties in doing that. But you can also take the point of view, we measured some fluctuation level. It actually agrees remarkably well with what's predicted by cosmological models that are favored on other grounds. So we don't actually have a lot of room for additional disturbances. So somehow it appears that the Lyman Alpha Forest is relatively undisturbed. I think it's not so implausible because there aren't a lot of simulations yet of gas outflows from galaxies, but those that there are suggest that not much mass actually gets out, but a lot of metals get out because the supernovae blow their own channel and then send just tenuous gas out. And so the amount of energy that actually ends up getting transferred may not be that large. And then the gas will settle back towards this equilibrium on a Hubble time scale.
So what do you do with the energy?
Well, so there's radiant energy that gets out, but that's so if not much mass is getting out, then there's not that much kinetic energy. Unless a lot of it is in fact getting radiated away from because the supernovae are also trying to heat the surrounding interstellar medium, and that stuff is cooling away. So I mean, I think it's not obvious that you can get it all to work, but it seems as though somehow the universe is figuring out how to do it. Well, I think that what seems to happen in at least some of these simulations is, you know, you get these quite asymmetric outflows because, so, you know, the supernova is sort of heating stuff all around, but they've blown kind of a channel through the disk, and that's where they send everything out. So you can have a relatively small amount of tenuous gas that escapes taking a lot of the metals. I'm not sure that's true, but maybe that's correct.
Okay, before we get over-simulated, we want to open up the discussion, so Michael, you should